Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
It's Valentine's Day, which gives us an excuse to talk about love and respect and communication. Today on Talk of Alaska, we're delving into what makes a healthy relationship, both romantic and otherwise, with two local therapists to explore the issue from many different perspectives. Stay with us on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska. In rural Alaska communities, village public safety officers make a difference every day. Hired regionally, VPSOs are trained in public safety services such as community policing, fire prevention, life-saving emergency medical response, and search and rescue. VPSO receive competitive pay, benefits, and opportunities for advancement. To start your career in public safety and learn more about becoming a VPSO, go to vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by VPSO.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Ann Hillman, filling in for Laurie Townsend. And today we're talking about healthy relationships with Renee George, an associate professor of counseling psychology at Alaska Pacific University, and Emily Mechtenberg, a licensed professional counselor at Love and Liberation Therapy. And this is a conversation for all of us. So we'd love for you to join in. What are your thoughts on healthy relationships? What are your thoughts on unhealthy ones? You can join the conversation and ask any questions by calling 1-800-478-8255 statewide. If you're calling from Anchorage, it's 907-550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah. Thanks for being here, Emily. Emily's joining us over Zoom, and Renee is right here in person. Before we jump in, I'd really like for you guys to give a bit more proper introductions and talk a little bit more about kind of what you do and what you do in relationship to relationships. So, Renee, please.
Sure. I teach at Alaska Pacific University in the Counseling Psychology Department. I teach undergraduate courses. Some of those are in human sexuality and relationships and family systems. I also teach counseling skills classes to some of our graduate students.
Okay. And Emily?
Yeah, so I'm now running a private practice, as you mentioned, called Love and Liberation Therapy. I'm working with both individual clients and working with couples, and I'm providing sex and relationship therapy. So that entails me doing anything from addressing physiological symptoms. So basically, how is a person's body responding to various sexual contexts? To improving communication between partners, or just if an individual is coming in and wanting to shift the way that they're communicating in some way in various relationships. Talking about consent and boundaries in relationships, helping individuals determine their wants, needs, those types of things in all kinds of relationships. So yeah, that's the kind of work that I'm doing these days.
Excellent. So we're here today with the premise of talking about what a healthy relationship is and kind of delving into that more deeply. So I'd kind of like to hear what each of you would describe as a healthy relationship. Like, what goes into that? Emily, what is a healthy relationship?
Sure. So I when I think about healthy relationships, I think of them in terms of characteristics or qualities that are present in them. And so kind of some of the top qualities I think of, the first is respect, meaning, you know, is there an ability in the relationship for a person to accept where the other, where their partner or friend or whomever they're in relationship with, where that person is at, accepting them for who they are, even if it is different from how you are, and, you know, what level of fondness and admiration is there? Are there feelings of fondness and admiration? The quality of trust being present in a relationship. So feelings of safety, and is this person consistent and reliable? Boundaries being present in the relationship. So if you're telling someone that there are certain ways that you need to take space for yourself, or that you need to have some distance in the relationship, whether that be emotionally or, you know, how often it is that you're connecting, boundaries can come in all, show up in all different domains and relationships, but that you're feeling respected in your limitations in relationships.
Okay.
Whether you can maintain a sense of individuality in your relationships too. So those are some of the top ones that I think of.
Okay. And I definitely want to get into some of those with a little bit more depth later on. Renee, what would you add to this list?
Well, I agree with the respect, the trust, the boundaries. I think those are all really important. I think it's also really important to remember that relationships change over time. Sometimes we get this idea that relationships are static, or we get ideals of perfection in our head, and perfect relationships just don't exist. So understanding that the relationship will change, understanding that people are whole individuals, they're neither completely good nor completely bad, and figuring a way to negotiate what you need and want out of a relationship, keeping open lines of communication and being open towards the other person's change or growth in a relationship, I think is really important as well.
Because relationships, like, it's not just like a dichotomy, right? It's not like, oh, this is a healthy relationship and this is an unhealthy relationship. Is it, like, are things on a spectrum, and they, like, sometimes, like, this moment in time, it's really good, but it, you know, you go through hard times and maybe it's not so healthy.
Absolutely. I mean, relationships, especially the longer you're in a relationship, I think probably people have all had friends who at some points they felt very connected to and very attached to, and at other points those friends have not been as available to them as they wanted them to be. That happens in our romantic relationships as well, especially over time as people's needs and boundaries change. And things happen. Situations come up in relationships that lead to different levels of availability.
Okay. And this is kind of for both of you. When you're in a relationship and things do change and you're not comfortable with the changes, or like you're not quite sure why the other person isn't as available as they once were, how do you navigate that? Like, how do you have a conversation about that?
I start off with, hey, you're not as available as you once were. I mean, that seems kind of, you know, blatant, but I think if you're open and honest and you communicate in your relationships, you can get over those humps. Sometimes you just know why the person's not available. They may be really stressed at work, or something else has come up in their life and they're putting a lot of attention towards that right now. And sometimes it's distance. So there's a whole lot of reasons why somebody just can't be as available for you as they were maybe last week or as they're going to be next week. And I think continuing to negotiate that with people is the important thing.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Just sort of understanding being in long-term relationship with anyone that those changes are to be expected. And I think too, like, another characteristic of like health in relationships is being willing to be vulnerable what you notice in the relationship, as Renee said, just naming it. And if it goes long enough, you then have the opportunity to share, you know, maybe what feelings are coming up for you being on the receiving end of someone not having as much availability.
Emily can't see me nodding my head while she talks.
Sometimes logistics of in-person and Zoom together get complicated. I think everyone in the world knows that these days. It makes relationships more complicated too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So earlier, Renee, you brought up this idea of an ideal relationship. But like, you know, things like you see in rom-coms or movies or whatever. How do you avoid trying for that? How do you avoid like making that your measurement of success in a relationship?
I think that's hard to avoid making it your measurement of success. We all have this ideal in our head, and that could be from like the rom-coms, or it might be from other relationships that you've seen. Maybe you see a couple out there and you think they're just the perfect couple. Of course, you don't know what's happening within their relationship. You only see it from the outside if you're not part of that couple. Or we have maybe from when we were growing up, these idealized versions of the couples who stayed together that we think are really tight and connected. There might be public couples like, you know, I don't know, maybe the Obamas or George and Laura Bush or something like that. The political, I'm just kind of thinking of political kinds of couples or couples that we all might have seen or heard. And we kind of say, oh, that. I like that relationship, but we don't really know what's happening within it. And so I think when you're in your own relationship, being honest about what you want is important, and also being respectful that you're not going to get 100% of anything that you want in a relationship from one other person. I mean, I think we have this ideal that there's this one perfect soulmate out there, and once we'll meet this one perfect soulmate, all will be right in the world. And I think, you know, maybe for three people on the planet, that's been the case. But I'm not sure that that's a reality. I think we make our soulmates by continuing to connect our souls to them as we're in relationship. So I don't think they're perfectly formed. I think we create those soul connections as we go along.
So it's kind of constant work.
I would say, yeah.
Emily.
Yeah, Renee. Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I couldn't agree more that, you know, that it is a lot of effort and that it is hard not to try and model ourselves after what's represented to us by culture and the media and things like that. And so to socially diversify and have access to all kinds of social love and support can be really helpful to most of us.
So are you saying that like, basically, we shouldn't expect all of our emotional needs to be met by a romantic or just like a life partner, romantic or not, and other relationships, like we need them to balance things out. Renee's nodding. She's like, yeah. Emily, what are your thoughts?
Yes. Just absolutely echoing what Renee said about, you know, the one being a concept that for I think few people can work. And maybe, like you say, three people. Renee has worked, but
maybe it's 30. I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. A small sample there from the population, but yeah, that social. I mean, there is more and more research that shows that, for example, even folks who are single do tend to create rich and supportive social networks for themselves where they get a lot of fulfillment. And so, you know, just thinking about that and how healthy it is for folks, for example, in long-term monogamous marriages to have access to other social supports outside of their partners, that is not only healthy, but necessary, and the detriment that can come to folks when they lack access to social supports outside of their partners.
Like, what are some of those detriments?
Well, there is research, for example, that shows that for older American men, that there's a lot of loneliness mm-hmm. that can happen. And you know, just more challenging, not being able to process emotions, feeling a lot of isolation. Mm-hmm. Those types of detriments can come from that.
Okay. So at what point, like we talked a bit about kind of how media influences ideas of what should go into relationship and what a relationship is. At what point should we start teaching kids and teens about what makes a healthy relationship, both romantic and otherwise?
Right from the get-go. I mean, as soon as they're born, even maybe before they're born. So what we do know is that those attachments you make in the first couple of years of your life set the foundation for relationships that you're going to have later. So it's really important for us to make sure that kids get really good nurturing and support when they're young and feel attached and have at least one, preferably 3, 4, 5 caring, supportive adult figures who they can go to, who they know love them, trust them, expect them to do well, hold them in high regard. If we have those things growing up, we recognize them as adults. We recognize them pretty easily as adults. If we don't have them growing up, it becomes harder then to form adult relationships that are going to be healthy and beneficial to us.
So with that in mind, if someone grows up with a lot of trauma and grows up without those healthy attachments, how does that affect them later in life, and can you heal from that?
You can heal from it. It's tough, though. So if you learn from an early age that the world is untrustworthy and others are untrustworthy, then you violate sort of one of Emily's top three, right? Then it becomes hard to trust others, and it becomes hard to be a trustworthy person in relationship. So yes, you can get over it. Therapy is one way. We do have a lot of research that shows that when people engage in a trusting therapeutic relationship, they can take that relationship that they develop and that attachment that they develop and transfer it on to other relationships. So a lot of that involves some work on yourself, understanding why it's hard to trust, understanding why it might be hard for you to be trustworthy. And a lot of that is also trusting yourself, trusting your own intuition, learning to respect yourself, learning to be somebody who can be in a relationship that is healthy, which is a process that we all learn, hopefully ideally from childhood in a positive way, if not through therapy, through friendships, through other trusting, healthy relationships. Doesn't have to just be therapy, but developing trusting, healthy relationships helps you develop more trusting, healthy relationships.
And Emily, when you're working with clients, how do you help them develop trusting relationships?
Yeah, it is quite a process. And, you know, Renee spoke to a lot of it where, you know, it is, you know, one of the things that I did not have such an awareness of until I became a therapist is how much when I'm in session with clients, that clients are really relying on my nervous system and my state of presence to build that trust. And so, you know, I think it's a huge learning process, in particular, if you've had developmental trauma or trauma as a child in relationships with primary caregivers, like your parents or whomever it was you were raised by. And so I think the consistency that I provide, both just, you know, showing up, and the consistency that I provide just being in a present and like loving and receiving emotional space when I'm in session with clients, and then just talking with them about what is healthy and what isn't healthy and what they can expect in relationship to others, and what if certain behaviors are showing up in their relationships, you know, for example, abusive behaviors, that they do have power. I think a lot of folks need to learn where their power lies in adulthood, that when we're children, we just don't have access to that power. And so a lot of folks as adults need to learn, you actually have a say here, and then to actually implement that say and implement stand in your power as an adult. Well, that in and of itself can be a learning experience. Huge.
I don't even know. Tell me more what you mean. Like, we as adults have power and that we need to understand where that power lies.
Yeah. So for example, you know, when we're children, if we go through relationship ruptures, or if we go through traumatic events with those who are supposed to care for us, which many of us do, and many of us come out just fine, you know, we heal through that as adults. But if we endure those things, a lot of times it can be difficult for us to trust. And so when we're children, our nervous systems tend to respond by shutting down often. You know, children will hide, they will pretend like they're asleep, you know, things like that. That's how we protect ourselves when we're children, because we don't have our full fight or flight on board yet, because we're tiny. And we can't outrun, you know, things that are threatening to us. And so when we're adults, well, our nervous system responses will tend to be almost default into what they did when we were children. And adults often have to learn, you know, I can flee. I can leave this situation. And when I was younger, I could not. And so just connecting those dots of like what you have power and control over now that you did not back then can be very healing for people. And it's also really hard. So it's a lot of standing in that power can also be building social support networks so that you can exercise your power more, so that you have people who will stand by you when you do things like flee a harmful situation.
I think it's also about those boundaries that Emily was talking about earlier. So knowing what you can say yes to and what you can say no to, and having those yes and no's respected, I think is also a form of power. As children, mm-hmm. it's, you know, you say yes and your parent says no, and you get a no. The answer is no, right? But as adults, sometimes people have to learn that we can choose differently than how others choose. And there's some power in that, for sure, to say, I do want this in my relationship. I don't want that in my relationship. And we can negotiate in ways that we couldn't as children as well. So learning how to do those negotiations is also important, I think, in terms of owning your power. I think the other thing is just sort of knowing what you're feeling when you're feeling is a certain kind of power.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes people are, you know, overwhelmed and they don't know if that's fear or anger or if that's joy even. Sometimes it's hard to sort that out for people. And there's a certain power in knowing what it is that you're feeling and being able to share that with another individual. And there's a power in vulnerability as well. So Emily was talking earlier about how being vulnerable is important. I think knowing that you can be vulnerable and still be safe is an incredibly powerful feeling.
And I'd like to invite callers and listeners to join this conversation. When have you owned your own power? How have you known how to negotiate power dynamics in your own relationships? Join us with questions and comments. You can call us at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, you can call 907-550-8422. We're also taking emails at talk@alaskapublic.org. We talked a lot about when you're in a healthy relationship and how to exert yourself in a healthy relationship and express yourself. On the flip side, are there cues to know when your relationship isn't that healthy right at this point? I mean, there's some obvious things and some less obvious things, I'm assuming.
There are definitely some obvious things and less obvious things. So for sure, it's not okay to be hurt in your relationship physically. That's a pretty obvious thing. I think that's not obvious to everyone. Sometimes people think that a little bit of pushing or shoving or maybe threatening or intimidating is okay because they've learned that jealousy is a form of love, or they'll excuse that kind of thing. So part of it is learning. For some people, that behaviors that they've experienced in the past maybe are not necessarily helpful in their current relationships. Sometimes it's just if you feel really uneasy. I think it's hard sometimes for people to trust their intuition in relationships. If you've grown up with all that healthy support and good attachment, it's a little bit easier as an adult. And good news is that about 3/4 of us do have those healthy, secure attachments as children. It's a little bit easier when you're an adult to trust that intuition, to know kind of something's not quite right here. We often all second guess ourselves in relationships, though. So here's this person I really care about, and they're telling me something, and I'm getting the sense that this is not quite right. But I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, and I'm going to wonder if it's me, and I'm going to wait. I'm going to go talk to all my friends and check it out. And when I talk to all my friends and check it out, chances are I'm going to pick and choose the ones who are going to say, no, Renee, that's not you. That's that other person. Because I want that support.
Yeah, yeah.
So you got to kind of take your friends with a grain of salt. But if the preponderance of the evidence is pointing to this being maybe a problem, your friends are saying it's a problem, your ideals of relationship are saying a problem, your gut is saying this is a problem, then maybe it's a problem.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Renee, I really appreciate all of those examples. You know, one tool that I use often with clients that is very helpful in clarifying for relationship dynamics that are harmful, it's called the power and control wheel. And anyone can Google it. It's free and available. There are different versions of it, but some of them are more like gender neutral and some of them are more gendered, but they're mostly the same. And they, the power and control wheel, talks about 8 different domains of, a relationship that can hold harmful or abusive behaviors. And some of them are like things that I think were normalized in lots of households, even if there was a lot of, like Renee mentioned, secure attachment happening between caregivers and children. Things like the silent treatment are on that power and control wheel. And I think many of us wouldn't recognize that as a harmful or abusive behavior in a relationship, but it's a great wheel because it points out things that could go unnoticed or not identified as abusive. And so I think it can be a really handy tool for folks to look at, you know, am I doing any of these things, and or is my partner doing any of these things in our relationship? And if so, let's go ahead and work on eradicating that ASAP.
Let me just add in, so if people are Googling it, it's the Duluth, Minnesota power and control wheels. They also have an equality wheel. So it's nice to kind of put the power and control wheel at one end and the equality wheel at the other and think about relationships as a continuum. So the equality wheel has examples of how not to have a power imbalance in your relationship. So there are things like one of the things on there would be like economic abuse. So if one person is making all the financial decisions and the other person doesn't have access to finances on one side, and on the other side, it's we have shared decision-making around our finances, and that's on the other side. Now, that doesn't mean you have to have a shared bank account and that everybody has to know exactly what everybody else is spending all at the same time. That means that your decision-making around your finances is shared versus one person making all the decisions around finances. Mm-hmm. Now, if you and I are in a relationship and we agree, I hate to deal with money, you love to deal with money, and I trust you and I say, go for it, you're in charge of all the money, and I'm just gonna, you know, like let you do that, then that's shared decision making.
Okay.
Right? So and as long as we can renegotiate it, it's still shared decision making.
Okay. And we do have a caller comment who didn't feel like going on air, which is legit, but they wanted to bring up that an important piece of power is that everyone has the ability to hang up the phone during an unhealthy conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
And like I've heard of situations where it's like where people can say, all right, we're putting this conversation on pause till we're at a healthier place or like a calmer place to discuss this. Is that a good way of going about some really hard conversations instead of doing something like the silent treatment?
I'm going to jump in here, Emily. I'm going to say absolutely yes. So if your partner needs time, so we process information differently. And some of us need a lot of time to think about what we want to say, and we need a lot of time to think about our feelings. The worst thing that you can do if you're a person like that is to give a cold shoulder or a silent treatment. We have lots of research evidence that shows that that's one of the most damaging things you can do in a relationship. But if you're a person who needs all that time and you say to your partner, look, I need time to sort my stuff out before we talk, and you also make an appointment or a date to get back to them, like, can we talk about this tomorrow in the afternoon after I've had a chance to think about it? That's helpful. That tends to be useful. And if somebody's yelling at you on the phone or screaming at you or engaging in a conversation with you in a way that's hurtful, you can say, thank you, I'm out. And you can hang up the phone for sure. You can also, if you're in the middle of an argument with someone and it gets kind of heated, you can say, we need a timeout from this argument. Let's pick this up later. I'm out. I can't do this right now. I'm overwhelmed. I have, you know, my anxiety is racing. I'm starting to feel panicked. I don't want to be in this relationship right now. So I don't want to be in this conversation right now. And I'm not sure I want to take that with me for the whole of the relationship. It's this moment, right? So stepping back from those moments and letting your partner know that you're in that space can be really helpful. But then again, you got to be vulnerable, and you got to trust that your partner can be vulnerable with you. And it's helpful if you set up rules at the beginning that say, you know, there's going to be times when I'm overwhelmed, I'm going to need to step out and take some time, or there's going to be times when I can't talk about this. I'm going to need to sort out what I'm feeling before I can engage in a dialogue with you.
That seems Emily.
Yeah. I was just going to say, definitely, Renee, all of those, the breakdown of that, you know, being intentional is huge. So like you say, either setting rules and being clear with your partner that, like, you are feeling activated and you need a break. So just conveying what is happening assertively, but not aggressively, and talking about how you do plan to circle back. I do want to address this. I don't want to sweep it under the rug. And then doing things like using I statements in those heated moments, like taking ownership of your own experience, like, I'm feeling really anxious or activated, instead of saying, you seem, you know, like you're having some feelings come up right now, can be great for not eliciting defensiveness in our partners. So yeah, all of those things that Renee mentioned can be a really useful way to step away from the conflict, but also plan not to sweep it under the rug.
All right. We are going to take a quick break, and then we will be back with more conversation around relationships and healthy relationships.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
In rural Alaska communities, village public safety officers make a difference every day. Hired regionally, VPSOs are trained in public safety services such as community policing, fire prevention, life-saving emergency medical response, and search and rescue. VPSO receive competitive pay, benefits, and opportunities for advancement. To start your career in public safety and learn more about becoming a VPSO, go to vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by VPSO.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about healthy relationships. What are your thoughts on healthy relationships and power dynamics? What about relationships beyond romantic relationships? Join the conversation by calling 907-550-8422. You can also reach us statewide at 1-800-478-8255 or email us talk@alaskapublic.org. We've been talking a lot about romantic relationships and kind of some of the bigger relationships in our life. Earlier on the show, I think both of you actually mentioned things about self-love, how you actually really have to love yourself as well. I'd love to talk more about that. Like, why is that so important, and how do you do that? Sometimes it's really hard, right? So, Renee, why is that important?
I think, I want to say RuPaul says something along the lines of, if you can't love yourself, how are you going to love anybody else? I just love that quote, but it's true. You have to have a certain amount of respect for yourself, care for yourself, self-knowledge in order to interact with others. If I can't sort out my feelings, I can't sort out my feelings for you. If I don't respect myself, I'm going to allow you to engage in things in relationship with me that are just respectful to me. So how do you do that? Again, it goes back to that starting young, making sure that kids know that they're valued and respected. And then collecting around you friends and support people who value and respect you, and can call you out if you're devaluing yourself or disrespecting yourself. Who can point out your strengths, learning what your strengths are. One of the things I used to do with people who had a hard time doing this was, it's a simple little exercise. Anyone can do it. You know those pros and cons lists? You know, on one side you put all your pros, on the other side you put all your cons. It's a real challenge for some people to put strengths on one side and weaknesses on the other side, and then only fill up the strength side and not write anything on the weakness side. But it's a challenge because we want to say, oh, I still want to fix this thing or that thing's not okay. But just focusing in on what makes you the unique person that you are and valuing and appreciating the unique person that you are. There's also a field of positive psychology has been growing over the past 20 or 30 years. And there's a lot of things that you can do to help ground you more in yourself. Things like savoring, taking a few moments every day and just appreciating your senses and loving the information you're getting from the environment around you can be really helpful in learning how to appreciate yourself. Learning to love your body exactly as it is in this moment now, whether it's sweaty or growing hairs in places you don't want or aging and drooping as mine is doing. You just have to be fond of it. It's the one you got. It's serving you well.
I feel like I have this conversation every single day.
Yeah. just finding things. I mean, you can look at stories of your successes and sort of pull out what it is about you that makes you strong, capable, successful, whatever your words are, lovable.
So kind of negating the negative self-talk, and you have to train yourself to do it.
It's hard. It's hard. We're bombarded with images, again, of these ideals about what we should be or how we should be or that do not necessarily serve us.
Emily, what would you add to that?
Yeah, as Renee's been sharing, I've been reflecting on, how often it is that I connect with folks who don't know what they want or need, or what, having a difficult time hanging on to their own truths in the context of their relationships, and how so many of us are raised to people please, that's a way that we receive love. And so it's so easy when we practice that through the course of our childhoods into adulthood to lose our sense of what we want or need in relationships. And so to speak to strengths, as Renee was saying, one of the things when I work with clients is that I focus on sort of the strengths of people pleasing. Like, what is it that you've been receiving from playing that role for so long? Because there is a positive function to that people pleaser part kind of showing up and working so hard for you. And then we can often uncover like aspects of themselves that have been hidden, sort of maybe a self-advocating part that has been sort of waiting in the wings to be acknowledged and wanting to come forth. And so really it's understanding like the positive side of those behaviors that you wish weren't there, but have been there for good reason, and then discovering like what else is behind that so that you can find a new connection to yourself that's been there but sort of been dormant in a way.
Oh, I love that. Finding strengths and even the things that you criticize yourself about. That's great.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would like to invite Louise from Kenai onto the show. Louise, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about yourself?
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to mention something that I've got from the perspective of being old as dirt. I have my second husband and I have been friends for 50 years.
Wow.
He came looking for me in Alaska about 20 years ago, and we've been together since. And I must say that building a relationship on a friendship has been one of the nicest, most warming, and stable experiences I've ever had.
That's a beautiful sentiment. Thank you for sharing that.
I wanted to say, friendship comes first.
I love it, Louise. I think you're right. I think friendships comes first, and often friendship comes last. So in romantic relationships, for sure, if you can't be friends with the person, you know, when you go through those tough times, you're going through them without a friend, you know? So I think it's really important part of a stable relationship.
It is. And, you know, I'm not going to blame just young people, but often young people fall in lust before they fall in love. And Steve and I were friends long before there was any physical relationship at all. And, you know, as I say, it's been just wonderful. He's a great guy.
I'm happy for you.
Congratulations to you both. Thank you for calling.
Okay, thank you.
You know, Louise talked about the importance of friendships. And we've been talking a lot about kind of two-person dyadic one-on-one relationships. That's not the only kind of romantic or otherwise relationship out there. Emily, you do a lot of work with not just couples, but other types of relationships. I'd love it if you could talk a little bit more about that and what that includes.
Sure, yeah. So one of the things that I specialize in is working with people who are in open relationships. So I use the term open relationships sort of as an umbrella term to include all kinds of multi-partnered relationships. So that could be people who are swingers, people who identify as polyamorous, people who are practicing monogamish relationships. There's quite a range under the umbrella of open relationships. And so, yeah, I have been, you know, since I was in grad school, and I should say Renee George, who's on the air with me now, was one of my professors back then. And as Renee knows, I did a lot of my focus during grad school on open relationships and non-conforming relationships. At that time, 2016 to 2018, there was a lot of burgeoning research on open relationships. And so what the data shows is that more and more people are interested in forming multi-partnered relationships, whether that be romantic or sexual or a combination thereof.
Okay. And are there benefits to having multi-partner relationships?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are benefits to having multi-partnered relationships. And so, yeah, some of those are that one of the things that we know about the challenge of being in monogamous relationships, although I want to say that I understand monogamy to be as legitimate as any open relationship and as legitimate as people who choose to be single mm-hmm. for, you know, extended periods or even lifelong. But yeah, some of the benefits specific to consensual non-monogamy or ethical non-monogamy, as it's known, also known as open relationships, is that a lot of people who are both high on the psychological trait of a need for security in their relationships, while simultaneously being high on the psychological trait of exploration, so wanting to connect with lots of other people, either romantically or sexually or both, can have those needs met in the context of open relationships. People who practice open, like consensual non-monogamy also tend to cite that they have large experiences with self-discovery, that just connecting with themselves more deeply, you know, and kind of generating more of that like self-love, like we were talking about just moments ago. Mm-hmm. That in these open relationships, that the variety that you're provided with increases the likelihood of need fulfillment. Because as Renee was mentioning at the top of the hour, that we do have so many needs, relational needs, and that relying on one person for that often just doesn't cut it for us. It's really puts a lot of pressure on our one partner. And so diversifying in an open relationship can increase the likelihood of need fulfillment. And then, you know, for people who are higher on that end of exploration, they can feel like they're living towards their highest potential. You know, if you think of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs and that self-actualization or like living to your highest potential, it can feel like that if you do have a high degree of exploration as a psychological trait.
Okay. Are there any drawbacks at all?
Oh yeah, there are definitely challenges okay. to people exploring. I mean, I think one of the main ones that you'll hear about is just that it's still socially stigmatized. You know, that in and of itself can make it really hard to find community. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that is important for folks who are either considering changing their previously non-monogamous relationship to an open relationship, or for folks who are sort of beginning a new relationship from the standpoint of we're going to go into this openly, is that you need to find people who are going to support you, whether they themselves are monogamous or not. You're going to need to find people who can be there for you as you make that move. Yeah, and then I think maintaining that sense of security in the context of connecting more deeply with other people can be a real challenge. It absolutely can be done. It takes a lot of work and a lot of vulnerable communication.
In terms of remaining within the relationship or with outside of the relationship?
I would say both, ideally. It depends on the relationship's style. So, for example, we know that in swinging, generally, that's more sexual openness and emotional monogamy. And so in that context, it's a high degree of security that's experienced between what we call the primary couple. So a primary couple, like two partners, will go into like a sexual experience with other couples, for example, and they know, you know, we're just going into this with the intention of being physical, but as far as emotional connection, that is going to be limited. That's discussed between the primary couple generally. And so then there is not a lot of concern for attachments to develop, emotional attachments to develop. If the relationship is more, let's say, polyamorous, that's a relationship where both sexual and emotional connections can be developed. And so there's a lot of negotiation between what we call primary partners, the two partners that have had the established relationship. And then the new partners can be communicated with as well by both partners in the primary partnership, but not always. Sometimes it's kind of compartmentalized where one partner is talking with outside partners and the other person is not so much. It varies from one relationship to another.
And so every relationship, they kind of set their own boundaries and rules.
Exactly. Yes.
All right. We need to take another quick break and then we'll be back with more conversations around relationships on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The North Slope Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will develop proposals to change federal subsistence hunting and trapping regulations and discuss other subsistence-related issues. The public is invited to participate in the meeting February 22nd and 23rd in Kaktovik. More information at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We do have a few more minutes for any calls and comments. What are your thoughts on open relationships? What are your thoughts on how relationships can differ? Join us at 907-550-8422. Also 1-800-478-8255 or talk at alaskapublic.org. So it's kind of been mentioned in passing a little bit, this idea of you don't need a romantic relationship. Like, it's singledom is perfectly healthy and perfectly acceptable, even if society tells us it's not. Renee, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. There's lots of reasons why people might want to be single. Some people just don't have a whole lot of interest in romance or sexuality. And so they prefer just to kind of not have that business happening in their lives. Some people have a whole lot of reasons to be single for the moment. Maybe they haven't found somebody they want to connect with or groups of people that they want to connect with. Maybe they are really invested in a particular project or an activity and they just want to focus all their time and energy on that. There's lots of reasons why people would want to be single. Certainly things like having a lot of friendships and exploring yourself or not knowing exactly where you are. So we were talking before about self-love. So maybe you're in a period of trying to figure out who you are so that later on, if you want to be partnered, you'll be partnered with somebody who's a good match for you. Lots of reasons.
And Emily, would you like to build on that at all?
You know, I think, I would just like to add, I think the benefits that have been highlighted for people to remain single for extended periods, however long it suits them. You know, first, earlier I was speaking to the psychological traits of security and exploration. And what we know is, you know, there's this new identity in the queer community of like aromantic or asexual. And that's people who don't experience feelings of wanting to be romantic with partners and or wanting to be sexual partners. They experience little to none of those feelings. And it's absolutely normal to have that show up for you. And so one of the benefits of being single is that you can focus on your own priorities. You don't have to be considerate of what your partner might be wanting or needing. Having the freedom of movement and still having the ability to achieve deep human connection with friends and family and invest in a variety of relationships to develop that rich social network that we were speaking to earlier.
Within the queer community, do people end up having to like come out as asexual or come out as aromantic?
Coming out, I think of as always dependent on how it's going to benefit the person who would be coming out, right? Mm-hmm. So in some of their relationships, it may benefit them for people who they're connected to understand that part of them, that they're not having, let's say, sexual feelings show up for them.
Mm-hmm. Or if their friends keep trying to fix them up.
Oh, if their friends keep it, yeah.
For example, sure, yeah. Sure. But ultimately, it's always going to be up to that person. And they get to decide, you know, what kind of process that they use and whether they need to come out, how it's going, by thinking about how it's going to benefit them to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we probably have always had people who prefer to be single or asexual or aromantic. And we've always had people who prefer to have more than one partner. And I think, you know, in the past, we haven't just acknowledged this. I think what's different is we're starting to be a lot more open in terms of talking about different sexual orientations, sexual preferences, understanding of ourselves in connection with others. And so you're hearing a lot more about this, but that doesn't mean that it hasn't always been there.
Agreed.
And this might be out of the scope of either of your knowledge bases, but like, why is it that at least within our dominant Western culture, like we all are expected to be in monogamous relationships? Like, why is that the norm? And I guess I'd say, why is it heterosexual relationships? But like, why is monogamy considered the norm? Is there...
I'm not sure it is always considered the norm. I mean, so think about this. We've always had situations where couples have been married and not necessarily happy and given each other the nod to have extramarital affairs. That has always happened, right? The message around that has been, oh, those people must not really love each other. Oh, that must be a bad marriage. But some of those marriages have been very successful over time, mm-hmm. politically, financially, you know. They've created great children, for example. So, you know.
There's a lot of reasons to appear monogamous publicly.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is certainly the, certainly our social dynamic right now is very focused on that. Part of that, I think, probably has to do with religion. Part of that has to do with economics, you know.
I mean, our tax law certainly favors people who are legally married.
Yeah.
Yeah. Emily, would
you? Yeah. You know, something else that comes to mind with that question, Anne, is there is a great book called Sex at Dawn that theorizes, like, that monogamy came in response to the advent of agriculture.
Oh.
Yeah, it is an interesting, it was years ago when I read this, probably 2012, 2013. It's been a while. But that is a great read for folks who are curious about how monogamy came on the scene. So it's called Sex at Dawn, and I'm blanking on the author's names right now, but you can Google it. Dawn, D-A-W-N.
Okay, and why would it agriculture lead to a preference for monogamy?
You know, it had something to do with people basically like trading their daughters for land, something like that.
Okay.
So, I don't remember the exact story, but yeah, it's something along those lines. And so, it is an interesting question. I think it's hard for us to let it go because of how much it's been modeled to us. And I also think that we don't need to let it go. I think for many people, monogamy is a fantastic relationship container that has a lot of its own benefits. You know, I mean, for example, if you're high on that psychological trait of security, monogamy is such a great container for that, because it's just you and your partner are agreeing to keep each other secure in that container. And then if it is true sexual monogamy, mm-hmm. risks of STIs they can go to zero if it's true monogamy and no one's cheating.
All right. Thanks. We actually need to wrap up. We've only got a few seconds left. Thank you both very much, and thanks for everyone to listen today to Talk of Alaska. Our guests today were Renee George and Emily Mechtenberg. Our producer is Madeline Rose. We had Chris Hyde doing the audio engineering. I'm your host, Dan Hillman, and have a great day.
Happy
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.